Blog Talk Radio.
Are you ready for more propaganda? Well, you're in the wrong place at the right time. Columbo Chronicles is for critical thinkers. Let's welcome the consumer advocate for justice. Here's the Rose, Rose Columbo.
Hi, everyone. It's the Rose Columbo. And yes, today we're starting our show at 12:30, but only for today. Next week, we'll be back on schedule from 12 to 1, as I noticed a lot of emails asking about the show. Yes, we're here, we're live, and I have a returning guest, the wonderful and fabulous Judy Watson. And she wrote that great book you can find on Amazon.com. It is called Wings, and her entire family has been in the entertainment industry in Hollywood for many, many years. And she is well knowledgeable about what is happening and her research in not only Hollywood, but around the country. And I enjoy talking to her. But the last time we were on the air, we had some technical problems, and there was other issues she wanted to talk to us about. And so I invited her back today, and we scheduled for 12:30 to 1:30 Pacific Standard Time. And that, of course, is 3:30 to 4:30 over on the East Coast. You can always check your time and follow us every Wednesday from 12 to noon on the World Wide Web and check your time in your country. And also you can go to Rose for Justice, that's the number 4, where my blogs are, and find some of the radio shows there as well, roseforjustice.com, and read my political blogs on a myriad of topics. And just speaking about a myriad of topics, how about what's happening around the world and the concern for the rights of human beings and the right for freedom, liberty, rights, and for life. And you will want to read Obama's Thoris, political satire, fictional characters that has a message for the world, not just for America. But at the end of this fictional political satire with some humor and adventure, you will want to find out what is the message of this fictional political satire.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Columbo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world, written with an Orwellian twist. Will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Columbo, available at Amazon.com.
The Justice Club is back on Columbo Chronicles live podcast. Join Rose Columbo at noon and find out what tips she will provide in a world of little justice.
Howdy, folks. Just stopped in by my favorite restaurant, the Horseshoe Cafe. I highly recommend the home-cooked hot meals and piping hot coffee. In fact, it reminds me of my mom's home cooking when I was growing up. The customer service is excellent. Be sure to save room for the world's best desserts. Make sure you try a slice of fresh homemade pie. The Horseshoe Cafe is located at 154 East 4th Street in the heart of Benson, Arizona. The Horseshoe Cafe is right outside of Tombstone, Sierra Vista, and Tucson. Sometimes Patty and Mike stop by to welcome you. The staff at the Horseshoe Cafe looks forward to seeing you. Stop by to eat or relax. Cool down in the desert with a cold beer or your favorite cocktail. That's the Horseshoe Cafe. Oh, and don't tell anyone I told you, but some people think it's haunted. One thing is for sure. Be sure to bring your appetite.
Columbo Chronicles Live. Columbo is on their trail. Listen up at Columbo Chronicles Live.
Yes, listen up to Columbo Chronicles Live every Wednesday from 12 to noon. But only today it is 12:30 to 1:30 with our very special guest, and her name is Judy Watson, and you can find her fabulous book, Wings, on Amazon.com. So check that out as well. And let's just get started and say hello to Judy Watson. Hi, Judy. Welcome back to Columbo Chronicles.
Well, hello, Rose. Thank you very much for having me back. I really enjoy it, though I am not that knowledgeable and certainly not as much as you. And I do learn a lot from you, Rose. I have to tell you this. So
well,
I enjoy.
I appreciate
all
that.
Things you say. Yeah. And
well, I try
I'm
to give people
here,
food for thought. You know, expand the mind outside the box. Yeah. Make it a better world.
I wonder, well, I know that's what you're trying to do. Myself, I'm just trying to accept the world as I see it and also to gain some little bit of knowledge. And that's, I think, what most people try to do, just to keep themselves going and try to keep afloat. And separate
exactly.
What's real from the propaganda that we get in the news every day, you know. So.
And it's not that easy to do, obviously, you know, because people don't have the time to do, a lot of people don't have the time to do research and figure out what's true, what's not true. So they just take it as fact, whatever they hear on the news. And that's the serious problem because they know people are busy with their lives, of course, and they're taking
care
of children and they're taking care of their homes and their businesses and whatever else they're doing. So, you know, there's so much going on in the news. So I thought we'd do like a buffet,
okay.
a buffet of just kind of giving our take on what we think is actually happening with some of the comments that people make online. Well, for example, there's a gentleman named Kevin, and he says, call me a prude, but I'd rather have a president who hooked up with a stripper than one who showered with his daughter. Now, that's a pretty strong statement. What do you think about posts such as that one?
Well, you know, I've seen these posts, and I don't know what's real. I don't know what's real and what isn't real anymore. They've said some awful things about Biden. They've said some awful things about Trump. And then when I start looking back through history, is there anybody they didn't say awful things about? name me a president.
They probably say some awful things about us.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I know. So, you know, I mean, if we go back, they crucify Bush. They crucify Clinton. They crucify Carter. And I think that when it's all over, said and done, that's a great deal of pleasure comes to these reporters, these so-called journalists, who can now say the things they were always so afraid and intimidated to say at the time. And it's just so interesting to go back and be disappointed, really, you know, in what you learn about people you wanted to admire. And That's where I'm at. I'm like one of those people you read about. I worked a great deal. I don't think I even understood anything about politics till I retired. And then because I had free time, I began to use the internet and do research for myself. And when someone would say something, I'd think, and then I'd go look it up and I'd see the pro and the con. And that's how I began to have differences of opinions on the world in which I came to live in. But how do you feel about that?
Well, I have firsthand experience of corruption and injustices, and that's why I wrote the book back in 2010, Fight Back Legal Abuse, as a self-help book to awaken the people to the fact that we really have to be proactive and we have to learn more about our judicial system, because without justice, we have nothing. And then if we have a corrupt justice system, not all, but even a few in there can cause a lot of harm to our constitutional laws, our state laws, city, county, state. And so we have to be very vigilant and take 5 minutes to, you know, try to find out what laws they are passing, and also stay in touch with their city council, their county supervisors, their Department of Justice in their state, the White House. There's lots of material on being posted on what laws they're passing without you know, actually being that transparent, because they also conceal laws within other laws that they don't tell us about, and they fund
now,
them.
Now, where do you find that?
Or,
say that again, Rose. Where do you go to find that?
You can find a lot of information on, you can go to your congressional members' website, and you can read what laws they're supporting, what laws they're not supporting. You can, but I wouldn't just go to my own. I would go to the opposing side, too, and read what they're saying about it, because I believe you have to listen to both sides. I don't believe one side has all the answers or is doing the 100% right thing for the people. But I think they've gotten to a point today where they're bashing each other, and they no longer actually care about the Constitution or the people, because they're imposing their personal agendas on the people instead of the people imposing their constitutional freedoms, liberties, and rights as guaranteed by the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and state and federal laws. So we have to be really careful, in my opinion, to listen to both sides and then to actually read the law so that we can understand, you know, is it for our benefit or for their benefit? Is it taking away more freedom, liberty, rights from us? Is it taking away our sovereignty, making us a borderless nation of nomads? I mean, these are serious issues, because when it bottom line comes down to it, we, the people, are the ones who provide the wages of every taxpayer-funded, elected, and appointed official. And when they allow 35 million illegals into our country, and they're coming by the tens of thousands again, invade our country, we have to be very concerned, because they are using our taxes to support, aid, and abet, and harbor these illegals in our country, using our taxes and telling us we are the ones who have no rights, no liberties. We need to shut up and be quiet while they are violating their sworn oath and the federal and state laws on sovereignty that they are supposed to abide by, to protect the safety and welfare of the children first, and also every other legal American in this country who pays their wages. And we, the people, are the government. And I think that the people have forgotten that. I think that the government has put so much fear that if you open your mouth, you're going to be punished. You go to a school board meeting, you're going to be arrested if you aren't politically correct, if you aren't tolerant of the political correctness. And we've seen it over and over again in the news, where a parent is removed and arrested or removed from a city council meeting because they expressed their opinion. So this is very dangerous to our freedom, liberty, rights. But I'm not talking about just us. I'm talking about the children and the babies that will be the future generation of our country, who we are responsible to make sure that they have the same freedom, liberty, and rights that we experienced in our lifetimes. And I think that's very, very important. What do you think about that, Judy?
I was thinking back. Do you remember those wonderful television shows in which, what was the name of that one where they had he taught a class of immigrants how to speak? It was a famous comedy series. And then there was Molly Goldberg. And then there was, I think John Travolta was in one where it was a class of kids that were immigrants that were learning to be citizens. But when I would watch those, and they were all done in wonderful humor, there was never anything derogatory said about our country or posed in a derogatory way towards our country. And we knew that it was a positive experience, and people coming into this country felt they could draw upon a positive experience. and we could let go of the fear and anxiety, which is what drew us out of the old countries we lived in. You were talking about being Italian. I was talking about my husband having come from Ireland. His family, they traced it back. He was an indentured servant. They never talk about indentured servants. They were slaves, and I read 70% of them died. They were basically people who had allowed themselves for a certain amount of money to be bought by farmers over here or plantation owners, and the hope was that they would be able to buy their freedom. They lived under terrible circumstances. They worked, and most of the time they didn't make it. But his relative did and became an independent and free American. And his family had been in this country, we found out, since the 1700s. But how often, you know, do we know these stories? And it's very difficult to go back and trace the stories. My family came here in the 1800s. They came to get away from oppression. They were Jewish. And in particular, my grandfather's father was from, of all places, Kiev. But Kiev was Russia in those days. And but again, there were pogroms. Jews were killed outright. They were slaves in factories. They never knew when this would occur. And coming to this country was a wonderful feeling of freedom, freedom to live, freedom to make a choice, freedom to go on and be seen as people. It didn't come easily, very difficult. Many generations had to go through a lot of problems. But certainly that's what it held out, don't you think? This country represented that woman holding a torch of freedom, you know?
I definitely believe that, because my grandparents came here in the 1800s too. But the stories they told me was that they were living in poor villages in Italy, and they got married with the blessings of their parents to come to America and start a new life. And because the mafia was very heavy-handed, and so they wanted to escape that as well. So they came to America, and they said they were so excited when they saw the Statue of Liberty, and they kissed the ground when they walked on American soil, and they came here legally, and they didn't come here for a handout. They came here to work and to reach the American dream, which was to them to buy their home and own their own home and have a family and provide for themselves and their family and be a part of the community, which they lived in an Italian community near in Pasadena. And so the stories are amazing, you know, if people would ask their grandparents and their parents to tell them stories, especially since the World War II veterans are passing away, and the generation before that have passed away, most of them. So it's so important for natural-born Americans to hear and record, now that we have so much technology, those stories that their grandparents and their parents tell them about America and their experiences. Don't you believe that is so important to future generations, so that they have a blueprint?
Well, that's why I did my own memoir, and I did it because I thought what happened to my brother and I was highly unusual. And Larry and I in World War II were placed in a boarding school. And my father had been drafted, but the Army paid $22 a week. My mother had to go to work, and there were no social services. I do think that's one of the most important things that has to be recognized in this country, that we did not have food stamps, we did not have social services. People rose or fell by their own hand. And therefore, I don't know what your relatives did, but my great-grandfather started out as a peddler, and that was not unusual. And he went from place to place until he could afford to open up a general store, which he did. And then he and my great-grandmother ran this store, and it was a small area in Illinois. And then their children began to leave that small town, progress into Chicago, get into different businesses, spread out across the country, educate themselves. And this, to me, has always been what I see as the right determination in this country and what makes the country great. Because when I look back, we were so poor coming out of that war, and I wrote about it and how we lived, but I never felt poor. I didn't know, Rose. I wore hand-me-downs. I didn't know. I knew I was free to walk, and I was free to play, and I was free to experience just normalcy in my life, and that was so valuable. And then coming to California was the greatest thing that ever happened. And so we went on. And I think that's how people do remember. And I thought, finally, write it, Judy, because your children don't know. I remember my mother had died, and I finally read her memoir, and I was so astonished, because I knew absolutely nothing about her. And it opened up another world to me. And so one hopes, that's why I always say to everybody, do your memoir, because maybe your children don't want to read it right now. Yes, you'll pass away, and then maybe and probably they'll take the time to discover all those facets of you they didn't know. So that's how I see the world.
Yes, and it's interesting because you know, we're supposed to be progressing, but we seem to be regressing instead of progressing with all the new high-tech advancements they're making. When you're talking about, you know, like my grandfather, he moved from New York and to Colorado so he could work in the coal mine. And like you said, there's these books that you never know about. I just discovered a book when my mother passed away after the jabs in a couple of years ago, that I found a book that's published about the coal mines in Colorado where my grandfather is, I can't tell which one he is, but they have a group picture and they have his name listed in the book. And they talk about things I never knew about I was so shocked to get this precious book. Probably the only one around left, and that my mother kept, and it has my grandfather's name in it, and Philip J. Colombo. Philip J. is Felipe in Italian, but in the book they put Philip, and so it was so amazing to me because what it said was they had to stay at those camps. I didn't know any of this. They had to live at the camps during, you know, their work days because of distance. You know, they didn't have cars like we did, you know, to zoom back and forth and trains and all this stuff that you could just zoom back and forth to home and work. They had to actually get to the coal mine and stay there with their fellow workers. And then they would go home whenever they let them go home and be with their family. And that's how he saved enough money to reach his and my grandmother's American dream, because they had like 10 kids during that time period, and moved to California near Pasadena there. And I can't remember if it was in Pasadena, but in an Italian neighborhood, and bought their first home. And it had another home behind it. So when my parents married, we lived in the house behind them. So I grew up with my Italian grandparents, and I was at their home more than I was at home, because there was so much love and home cooking, and grandmother made spaghetti, and she actually made the noodles from scratch. Everything was from scratch. So it was a much healthier diet for young people back then, because the food didn't have any of the preservatives and the chemicals that they are or the pesticides they are spraying. I even remember it was a fun day for the family to go to the farmer's market. And when all the farmers came in and brought all the vegetables to the market, and it was huge. And it was like, this was entertainment. And I mean, today, the difference, what I'm saying, is that we appreciated everything. If we got a pair of skates, we were so excited. If we got a doll for Christmas or birthday, we were so excited. We were never ungrateful. We took care of whatever we got, and it was like precious. And because we couldn't go out and buy it again, parents didn't give us a credit card. Parents didn't just go out and buy us a Mercedes-Benz or a BMW. No, no, no. You better work even as a kid and do chores and either babysit or throw newspapers or go help your neighbor garden and mow his lawn. Whatever it was, we were taught to work, the value of work, whether it was build a lemonade stand and sell lemonade. And I find today it is so sad when under the 2009 era after that, they actually attacked the lemonade stands built by children and sold on their private property, demanding that the police make sure that the parents have a permit.
Are you kidding?
Or be fined. No, I'm not kidding. And that has stuck in my, I cannot tell you, a thorn in my side, because that teaches kids not only to build and create a lemonade stand, and also kept their minds busy, and they learned the value of selling, the value of earning money, and the value of saving money. And they could do whatever they wanted with their money. And once they had whatever the amount they wanted to save. So I find all these entitlements to be devastating to the minds and the creativity of young people today. What do you think?
Well, I'm trying to remember when it all began, because we didn't have it either. We moved out here. The kids were all, there were 22 children on my street at one time that would play together, oh, my God, in the summertime.
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah.
But,
and after school.
And they all played outside. Well, yeah, and they all played outside. Nobody came in your house, and
right.
Except when they were really little. And even then we had, I remember they were like 4 years old, and we would take turns. Maybe there'd be 8 or 10 kids in my den, but there was always somebody that was in charge, and everybody would have to clean up before they went home, and there was no yelling, no fighting, no problems. And the parents just gently said, now it's time to go, or now you can leave, you know. And that's how I remember it. But then it started probably when my kids got into high school that my daughter decided to get into designer jeans. Remember? Oh, my gosh, jeans came in, and
Gloria
they couldn't
Vanderbilt.
Just be. Yeah, no, it wasn't Gloria. It was another name, but very fancy mm-hmm. name. And then my son wanted to play a musical instrument, so we rented one. That's what we did. But then he had to have a nice one. And little by little, I saw how things began to change, and we became a child-focused society. We were not when I was growing up. We were not when you were growing up. And I think we need to come back in kind of a middle ground, because what I've seen is that it's so child-focused now with the laws and the rules and the rights of the children that it's gone way extreme, way too much to the extreme, where the parents have lost their rights and can only think in terms of what does my child want, you know?
Well, it was progressive because this attack on children, on parents actually, because in the, I think it was probably late 80s, they decided in California that you no longer had to address the teachers or adults as or other parents as Mr. or Mrs. or Miss. you could just call them by their first name, which was rather shocking because teachers decided they wanted to be the kids' friends.
Oh, that's interesting.
I guess. Oh, yeah. And then not only that, they also, I think it was either the late 80s or early 90s, when the lawyers decided that the children could divorce their parents if they were unhappy with their parents. They could actually file lawsuits.
Oh, yeah, I remember they could go to court.
And divorce them.
But on the other hand, Rose, I remember there's a word for that. On my door, one day there's a knock on my door, and it was a man investigating, and I found out that next door to me there was a young girl who was trying to establish her freedom from her mother. But in this case, her mother was a drug addict. The father had disappeared. She was living with her grandfather, and he was helping her. But it all went through the court system. She did win her freedom. And so this began a platform that we had never seen before, but it was a form of child protection. Quite honestly, I was for it if children were growing up in those sets of circumstances.
Well, I quite honestly wasn't for it because we have child protective services. Child protective services are to interview the child and when there's a problem, not just the parents who are going to deny child abuse. And so we have already a process. We don't need to go to court and file more divorces of children against their parents. That's ridiculous. They're not married. Divorce.
She was just seeking
married.
To establish. What was the word? There's a word for it. She was seeking to establish herself as an adult. She was probably around 15, 16. And, yeah, it went through the courts. I remember that. I was quite surprised. And then, you know what?
Yeah.
She
and
really
I
didn't.
Mean, because we already have an entire system set up for children. And it's actually the job of the judges to monitor the welfare of the children and also the safety and welfare of all children, which they are not doing by allowing the government to continue with these open borders that actually risk the lives of all the children coming in and out, not only American children, but foreign children who go missing as well. So in my opinion, the judges also are just as guilty who don't stand up for the children because that is actually part of their job duty. Did you know that?
Well, I don't think I told you, but at one point after Dick died, I thought, well, I've got free time. Perhaps I should join the foster child service. And I went to a number of meetings. And the woman at the meeting was so, I hate to say it, derogatory about the child protection services that I didn't join. Because basically you become almost a guilt. You have to be fingerprinted. And your first allegiance is not to the child. Your first allegiance is to the court system. And if a child confides in you, you must tell on that child and go to the courts and tell them what that child has told you. And the way the system worked, it took the child perhaps out of a bad home. The parents had no authority or ability to stop it. The child was then placed in foster care. And oftentimes they would be moved from one place to another place. Their education's interrupted. There were just so many negatives that I quit. I thought, well, I wouldn't be any good to anybody. Child could not confide in me because I have to tell on that child. And my allegiance seems more to the courts and to the officers of the courts. And, you know, I told you I worked in the law. And one of the things that provoked me and annoyed me was the fact that the court system is not built upon as much as it's built upon money and the creation of keeping that court system in place. Keep those judges there, even though many of them get in there and they shouldn't be in those jobs. You know that. It's a very political, many
I read
of
the
those
book
jobs.
On it.
Yeah, right. And then the officers of the court, they work in hand with the judges. And so if you want to get anywhere, you have to make them your friends. And basically, my feelings about a lot of these things is theoretically things are always terrific, but in reality, they often don't work. And that was why it was a very harsh reality for me working in the law firm and seeing that it was really who you knew you know. And
it's a rude awakening when you go into the system and you're expecting fairness and justice and mercy and an objective judge and lawyers that defend you. That doesn't always happen, unfortunately. And I was told that the first obligation of the lawyer is to the judge, and the bailiff's obligation is to the judge. And so, and then the lawyer's other obligation is to the other lawyer. And as you said, it's about the money to make sure everybody's going to get their fair share. And it's going to come out the way they already appear to
pre-planned.
Have pre-planned.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I know.
And, so I said, you know, in my book, Fight Back Legal Abuse, and I'm actually writing version 2 right now. It should be out this year. That without justice, there is nothing. We have nothing without justice, which is what we're experiencing today, country. If we don't have justice and we don't have objective prosecutors, objective defense attorneys, objective judges, objective bailiffs, and clerks and transcribers, court reporters, believe me, you can end up in a world of hurt and innocent
and
people can go to jail and innocent people lives can be ruined. And so it's the other thing I wrote is something to the effect that people enter into the judicial system with the illusion of justice, but they'll walk out of the legal system many times disillusioned by justice. And so, yeah, it's not all, you can walk in there with your rose-colored glasses, but they're going to strip them off of most people, because it's not black and white like the law says, because the laws can be rewritten. They can be ignored. They can be translated any way they want to translate them. They can be shredded. I mean, we saw the State of the Union shredded on worldwide television behind the president's back, and which was an insult to everybody who was a guest of the State of the Union and were being honored that night.
Why do you think Pelosi did that? Why do you think she did that? I watched that
and I
thought,
she has disdain for, I just think she has disdain for like Soros.
For Trump?
For Trump, yeah.
Nevertheless,
I mean, she's made many comments.
As good taste.
She's made many comments. She's, you know, I'm just saying that, you know, in the news, they've reported her comments. It's no secret that the left doesn't like Trump. That's just a giveaway.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody knows that. But my point is, whether you like Trump or not, that isn't my point. It could have been Biden standing there. It could have been Clinton standing there.
Correct.
In my opinion, it's such a bad behavior for the world to see. It's such a bad behavior for the children to see, for the up-and-coming lawyers and judges to see who are in school. I mean, it's just not professional appropriate behavior. And we are supposed to be leading the world. And whether you like someone or not, you don't take, you don't replace the person who is the focus of the meeting with yourself by performing something that exudes bad behavior. And it's nothing against her or anything. It's just the fact it could be anybody. You just don't do that. If your professor was standing in front of an audience and you didn't like that particular professor and you picked up his speech and you start shredding it in front of the TV cameras and the audience, would you think that was appropriate behavior and professional? Just because you don't like that particular professor or anybody else? businessman, whoever. To me, we have to return to some kind of courtesy, some kind of respect for each other, whether we like each other or not. In public, there has to be this illusion that, hey, we're all professionals. You know, we can accept different opinions and
well, either that
statements.
Or she could go on the stage. You know, she could go on the theater and she could go on the stage, and then it'd be interesting. I'll tell you, my brother grew up, and I knew him, with a man who became world famous. I've never told you this story. His name was Lee Brewer. And Lee came, I don't know, his mother was a widow. I met him when he was 15. I fell in love. All the girls were in love with him. He was beautiful at that time of his life. And then he went to UCLA, and he had no money. And in order to go into UCLA, he begins to write what we call very avant-garde. In other words, horrible stories. And his story that they loved was that a story of a woman so poor she throws her baby to death out a window. Hello. Okay.
Oh.
Well, they liked it. It was different. I mean, UCLA going way back into the, you know, 50s was very a conventional school out here. And so he works his way through UCLA. So I'll tell you a story. And then he does go on to become world famous. He writes a play that is shown in what's the famous park in New York, and Morgan Freeman stars in it, and he becomes world famous for writing avant-garde theater. It's all depressing as hell, and this is what he finds, that people do want these stories, but they want them in stories, they want them in plays, they don't want them in real life, you know, and so he was a very nice person, but this was where he chose to go. And he fed that audience that is always out there. So if you look up Lee Brewer, LeeBreuer, you will find he is world famous for this type of play, for his writings, for his avant-garde theater, for his belief that intrinsically the world is really no good and everybody's out to get you. And here, come watch my play. You know, and this feeds,
wow.
People feed upon this type of theater, yeah. And I'll tell you one funny story about Lee, and then I'll shut up, but this is hilarious. So I was about 17, and Lee was living wherever he could, and he invited me to a party. He was still at UCLA, and the party was to take place because he was living in a chicken coop, and I said to myself, a chicken coop? And I remember that I arrived at this, and it was a chicken coop. That somebody had carpeted and rented to him, and you had to get down on your knees and you crawled through the door, and then I got in and I crawled and I went all the way to the back. So I get to the back and I was sitting there, and a young man sits down and he introduces himself as a professor at UCLA, and I said, yes, glad to meet you. And he bluntly said to me that he wanted to have sex with me, and I said, didn't you just tell me that you're married and you just had a child? Oh, God. And he said, oh, you're so bourgeois. You're so bourgeois. And then he got up and he left me. And I crawled out back through the chicken coop and I went home. And so much for avant-garde. I mean, it sounds exciting and thrilling, different. Oh, my God. Life in a chicken coop, right? And that was the way Lee pretty much lived out his life. He had many partners, many children. And but never married until he married, and then, but he also had many other so-called marriages, and my brother told me a story where he and his friends, because of their childhood knowledge of him, they supported him for 20 years, and when he got famous, he didn't know him. God,
that happens a lot. I assume.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. I mean, your money. Okay, give me some money, but I don't know you. Wait at the door when I'm through, you know. And because this is often what people do. They look for some symbol of something that appears to be, oh, so different. No, folks, it's not different. It's just somebody else capitalizing on your stupidity and ignorance and taking advantage of you and, you know, writing this or appearing here or creating something. And, you know, and
yeah.
Don't be a sucker, you know. like Barnum said.
Yeah, well, married men have tried to, you know, play that. They're players, you know. They want to fill their ego up, and so they go out and they try to cheat on their wives, you know, so they can feel good about themselves, I guess. I don't know. But it causes a lot of pain in the end if the wife finds out. But the wife always knows, or the husband. It could work either way because their behavior is different, and the spouse's behavior becomes different. And so you know. I mean, you may not want to admit it. You may want to dismiss it. You want to ignore it. But the spouse will know.
I knew when Dick cheated on me because he would treat me in a much absolutely nasty way. And then but what could I say or do about it? I think you make a choice. And here, too, I'm just going to say to those who do listen, you do make a choice actively when you enter into marriage. Am I going to be faithful or am I not going to be faithful? And that is how you look at your life. I decided to always be faithful, and he decided not to be faithful. And, you know, so, and did it play out well? No, it never does. And
it never
people
does.
Have to, no, it never does. And there is no such
well,
thing
you know,
as a righteous
think the
person.
Grass is, people think the grass is greener on the other side, but if you have somebody that's a good person, and, you know, is really there for you. And you go off and cheat, you know, with some younger girl or whatever you're going to do, whoever it is. it's painful for the spouse, but it's also a losing move by the other spouse because in the end, you know, what did they gain if they end up going from the fire into the frying pan with somebody who doesn't really care, you know, but for other reasons, you know, entered into this sexual relationship with them. And sometimes, you know, it's the guy thinks or the girl thinks it's going to be a one-night stand and it's going to be over, but sometimes it's, what was that movie by with Michael Douglas and
oh my God! Yeah, where she
comes
obsessed
that movie?
With him. Yes,
something.
Oh, there's also the famous Clint Eastwood movie. I think the first one that I really where he directed, which was wonderful, in which
Fatal
he
Attraction.
Thinks that
Fatal Attraction. That movie was.
Fatal Attraction. Oh my God!
Oh,
and Clint Eastwood was very similar too. And Clint Eastwood, that became famous for the song Play Misty for Me, but I can't remember that. Gosh. But it was the same thing, an impulsive woman who besides that, oh, you're going to be my man. She comes after him. Oh, my gosh. So,
either way.
I do think these things are probably based on real experiences. That's how most good writing is, you know.
Well, I think all writing's based on somebody's experiences.
Correct. It's very fascinating. I do think, I'm going to say something nice here. I do watch a lot of Turner Classic Movies, and I really enjoy them because of the wonderful writing. I mean, the old times, they wrote such wonderful stories, and the acting. I watched Jimmy Stewart the other day, oh my goodness, in Vertigo, and I watched him in Rear Window. These were Alfred Hitchcock movies. And then there was an interesting discussion about the fact that even though Hitchcock was so famous, he never got an Academy Award. He never got recognition, which is, to me, one of those oddities of Hollywood. I don't want to go into Hollywood, but they have these marvelous actors, actresses, people, and then they don't reward them. And then they reward someone you never heard of, right? And and you're wondering, who is that person that just got up on the stage? You know? And you don't know if you'll see him again, right? So...
Well,
I mean,
it's like the Nobel Peace Prize, you know. You're like, well, shouldn't that person have gotten that award, you know?
Yeah, I know. Who is that
person?
I mean, I don't never heard of him yet. I know. So it just seems like, again, a kind of a Hollywood is an odd place. I think there's a wonderful expression about Hollywood in which people fail up. you know. So if they're really bad, they keep going up and getting more awards and things like that and finding better positions. And I've come to believe that this is true. But still, the writing, I think some of the writing, The King's Speech, if you ever have the opportunity to watch it, the man who wrote that was the most marvelous writer. He had written for the stage and screen. I think he's about 85 years old now. And he wrote this, I think, in his 70s, when in Hollywood, if you were over 40, you couldn't get a job as a writer. And again, I've never understood all the impediments that Hollywood throws in your face, but they seem to enjoy doing it. And so he opened up, you know, a whole world. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, if you're over 16, you're over the hill.
Oh, I know. Hollywood, it is what it is. And but one wonders who makes the rules this year. You got to look at this year, and because God knows what'll be happening next year, you know. And
interesting. I mean, we can look at the bad things about Hollywood, but you can also look at the good things. I mean, the wonderful movies they've produced, you know. I mean, thank God they've produced such wonderful movies because, some of them have so much human interest, or if you like thrillers or you like sci-fi, whatever it is, you can find it, you know. And if you're lonely, you can always watch a comedy and laugh, you know. I mean, it's like, romance, whatever. I mean, the like you said, in the old classics, the writing was amazing. And, you know, one of the movies that I watch every once in a while is, and I had my kids watch it too, and I thought it was so intriguing and, left you on the edge of your chair. I thought it was very well written.
I put on the Third Man. I mean, you know, the Third Man is made in the 40s, but it's Orson Welles. I mean, when you see the name Orson Welles, you stop and then you watch because you know you're going to see something really good. And so there are people, and John Huston and Walter Huston and all these marvelous, marvelous directors. When I see their names, I think, Dr. Zhivago. Every time Dr. Zhivago comes on, I watch it. And my God, it's 3 hours long.
But it's a fabulous movie.
David Lean. It's, Lawrence of Arabia. I mean,
Wuthering Heights. The original.
Yes.
Oh, I love it.
We'll never see
these
again.
One of my favorite
again.
Movies.
Yeah. And we won't.
Yeah,
they'll never.
They have to preserve. Thank God they preserve them because... And Betty Davis. I mean, if I see Betty Davis, I watch her movies, you know, because you know it's going to be good. You know, it's going to
be good. Well, I don't know if I told you. I think I told you about Wings. Now Wings is in the Library of Congress as the most important silent film, and I was the last one, I think, of its era. But at the time they did the picture, they didn't even know where they stored it. It got lost. And I think I wrote in the book because I was in touch with this man. My mother was in touch with this man who was the World War I Pilots Association, that they decided to do a retrospective. When they went to Paramount, the film was gone. They had to research, find the film, redo it, do the snapshots, make up a program, find the history, and they did a brochure, which I still have, which I primarily put in the book as an education for people to read so they would know what really was. And if you go on Wikipedia and you put in Wings, it will tell you it was lost several times. And finally, there was a man, and he is responsible for the museum downtown, and I did a whole video on him when I was typing up stuff at the home, who was Mayor. His last name was Mayor, and his dream was that Academy Museum. Also was hired and worked in the restoration for Turner of films. And thank God for this man, and thank God for Ted Turner, because they decided they were going to buy, restore, and preserve so many films that were just lost, forgotten.
I've bought so many DVDs from Ted Turner's library, you know, and it's like
right.
amazing. Because I always think, well, what if they disappear? Something happens to them. I have to have these movies.
They used to disappear.
So I have cabinets
and,
of them.
It made me sad because I typed up his story, and it was so wonderful. I went to this gal that was head of this department. I said, I would like to make sure that this man gets to type up a video, an interview. Oh, she said he has one. Where this is just for us. But his dream was to start the Academy of Museum of Arts, of Film Arts. And in 2008, when everything went bankrupt in this country, it died, and he was unable to find funding. Well, he died after that, and then when the dream finally came true, you know, and they created this academy down there on Wilshire, I think it was the old Broadway where they put the building, then they didn't give him credit, and I felt so bad. And there was some, now they're saying, oh, it began because there was a group of Jews. It wasn't a group of Jews. It was this one man. You know, who went to work for Ted Turner. And that was his vision. That was his dream. And so, and I think he was Jewish. His last name was just like a famous person that everybody hated, but his last name was Mayer. And and he was, anyways, but the point is, I was so happy, even though he was had died years before, to see the museum open. And I'm going to go to that museum. You know, I'm in this Motion Picture Moms group, which is so old. It's 80 or 85 years old. And they're going to have a tea down at the Academy in May. And we are being invited, which is very nice. I truly appreciate that. And it will be interesting to see this place, and people should, when they come into California, attempt to go down there, because that's where they're going to see the beginnings, I imagine, of Hollywood, you know, all the films and the motion pictures and the artifacts and histories. And I'll definitely want to do your show after that, because I'll let you know everything I see and find. But
I remember attending a luncheon when your book first came out at the Moms. What is it?
Did you come to that little luncheon? Yeah, I did.
And you
came.
You were signing your book.
And then,
you gave
and then you also came. I have to tell you that I think that luncheon that you came to in Beverly Hills, at the Beverly Hilton, was the very last luncheon, Rose, we've ever done. Because it was after that that we got
Peter
COVID.
Peter Selleck's mom was there, I believe, at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, Tom Selleck's mother. No, Martha Selleck was the president when I joined, but she had died. And Martha and Marilyn Mathers then became the president. Marilyn, I can't believe, is 95 and still going. And but she's
wow.
You know, way. I know.
That's great.
Very lovely lady.
I met Jerry Mathers at that and took a photo with him. Leave it to Beaver.
And very nice person. Yeah.
Oh, he was so sweet. I mean, he was so sweet. I was just totally
the whole family.
Impressed.
The whole family is just an extraordinarily kind, warm group of people, and so she's held this group together, even though I don't know how, because COVID basically destroyed it. A lot of people got sick. People died. People who had given a good deal of money passed away. And that's how groups die, because you have to have that money to keep funding it, to have it go on. And I don't know what will happen to the motion picture moms. They're trying to, they got on the website of the home. And if people are listening, the Motion Picture Television Fund, it's called MPTF, has a website, and they have a newsletter, and they put it out every month, and everybody, you can join. It's free. And it's very interesting because they'll normally tell you what's going on in the industry as well and not just what's going on in the home. And so it's just a little piece of Hollywood. And
well, thank
you so
much for that piece of Hollywood, because we're out of time. But I definitely want everyone to read your book, Wings. That's on Amazon.com, and it's an amazing book. And it has some wonderful stories in it, too, about Hollywood movie stars. that people haven't heard before. But Judy has a lot of secrets.
You know, next time you have me on, I'm going to read, if you will let me, I'll share some of the story. I have a lot of stories, and some of them are really funny, and some of them are really interesting. And I'll read a story, if you let me, on
that
the air.
That would be fantastic.
That would be nice.
I would love it. Thank you so much, okay. You fabulous lady, Judy Watson, and wonderful author. And we will do that, and I'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Take care, Rose. Bye.
And that's all we have time for today, folks. I hope you enjoyed our buffet of topics today. Kind of lighten it up there, too, because, you know, we don't need to be sad or concerned or worried about everything in life. We do have some wonderful things to offer that other people don't know about and can actually learn about. And, you know, find something fun to do. I mean, seriously, be happy. Smile. Life is precious. And don't let it pass you by. It doesn't matter your age. Age is a number, which is my quote. And you can do whatever you want to do and be whatever you want to be. And don't let anyone stop you. And just because they say no, just ignore them and keep on going.
Obamasaurus, the new book by Rose M. Colombo, is an updated version of a political satire that reflects the political roadmap of today's world. Written with an Orwellian twist, will humanity survive or suffer depopulation or extinction? Obamasaurus by Rose M. Colombo, available at Amazon.com.
Well, my friends, time flies. And now is the time to say goodbye. Thanks so much for being part of the Colombo Chronicles family. You are appreciated. Please do it now. Bookmark. Push that like, share, and follow button. Oh, and don't forget to comment below and stay in touch. Make your family part of the Colombo family. Until next Wednesday at noon, remember, God loves you, and so does the Rose.